Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host for today, Carla Nappi. I just spoke with Denise Phillips about her new book, Acolytes of Nature, Defining Natural Science in Germany from 1770 to 1850, and that just came out in 2012 with the University of Chicago Press. Now, this is a really wonderfully rich book. It's extraordinarily well-researched. It's just packed full of lots of interesting stories, accounts of the emergence and the multiplicity, and the sort of changing and transformations of some of the basic concepts that we now associate with the history of science in a context that spans the end of the 18th century and the early and mid part of the 19th century in Germany. Now, this is an example of the history of concepts and the history of emerging sort of categories and linguistic usages, and it's really in its best sense, in its most full sense, and it's very well grounded in a very rich account of what's happening in German history at the time period. There's a lot of wonderful stuff in the book. We had a great time talking about it, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, Denise.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today at New Books in Science, Technology, and Society to talk with Denise Phillips about her new book, Acolytes of Nature, Defining Natural Science in Germany, 1770 to 1850. This was such a pleasure to read, and thank you so much for making time for us today, Denise.
Oh, no problem at all. My pleasure.
So could you start us off by saying just kind of a little bit about what brought you into this field? How did you get into this topic in particular?
Well, I came to the history of science in graduate school having taken a lot of classes in American social history as an undergrad, and something that I felt very strongly in my first 2 years of graduate school when I was deciding on a topic was that I wanted to write about something that wasn't just about a small number of famous researchers. So when I kind of discovered this landscape of German voluntary associations that were really, you know, at that point people had not written a lot about, that seemed like a great way to do a project that had a much broader social reach than, you know, other topics I might have chosen. So that was part of my enthusiasm, was it was kind of carried forward from things that I'd found exciting about history as an undergraduate, and then encountering, you know, a field like history of science that is, for good reasons, often about small numbers of people, and wanting to find some way also to think about larger groups.
So this book, if I'm not mistaken, started off as a dissertation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the process of moving from the dissertation to the book manuscript, what was that process like for you? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Were there any sort of major transformations, any major changes, or was it fairly consistent from one to the other?
I think there were a lot of conceptual changes. Something that was a fairly late revelation for me in the revision process was how distinctively German the story I was telling was. I mean, the stuff that's in the introduction about, you know, the term Naturwissenschaft being hard to translate for most of the 19th century, that was something I found out only fairly late when I started doing a little bit of comparative research, actually for an article I was writing. And that really helped the argument of the book gel, I think, that comparative angle. And then I think, too, realizing that that really there was one division line, this division between the learned and the educated public, that was kind of the central driving pressure of the story. That was also a kind of, you know, I knew the story had something to do with the expansion of the public sphere, but that formulation also came relatively late in the revision process, and I feel like made the book hold together in a different way than earlier drafts had. So yeah, I feel like there were a couple sort of late revelations that really helped to bring things into focus for me.
Great. And were there any sort of historiographical items that you, or any people working in historiography or in history of science that you came across that you found particularly influential in shaping the way you thought about your own project?
Well, you know, Tom Broman is the obvious person who's also written a lot of really interesting things about science and medicine in the public sphere in Germany, and his work was very important for me early on. I was in grad school when Rainey Destin and Peter were working on the Objectivity book and was really interested in that project as well. And I think that the sort of whole project of historical epistemology was very interesting to me. And it was always important in how I was framing what I was doing from the dissertation, you know, up until the final revisions for the book.
This actually brings us to something that I wanted to ask you about, and I was sort of thinking of asking you about this later, but, you know, let's get right into it now. There's a lot of the arguments of the book, and it's for listeners who haven't yet gotten the chance to read the book, it's extraordinarily elegantly written. It's just full of not just wonderfully told stories of individuals and their families, but also the prose is very, very kind of elegant and embroidered and in a really nice way. One of the things that's consistent throughout the chapters and really that forms kind of the groundwork of a lot of the arguments in the book is a very careful attention to language and terminology. Mm-hmm. So throughout the book, the chronicling and describing of the changing use of terms is very, very important. And you state explicitly that one of the book's methodologies is to track the history of collective linguistic usage. Mm-hmm. So this seems related to the kind of work in the objectivity book that you mentioned and in the broader project or projects that we might subsume under the category of historical epistemology. And so I wanted to sort of ask you to talk a little bit about that. In particular, you give us a quote here from Quentin Skinner, I think, that when mm-hmm. writing the history of a word, tracing changes in meaning is not enough. We also need to look for moments when a word's reference changed or moments when it began to be used in new kinds of speech acts. And I think that's just a great quote. So can you talk a little bit about that as it shapes the way you approach this project? Because it does seem really central to a lot of the kind of work that you're doing in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that quote for me was a great way of expressing something that I had struggled with a way to articulate early in the project, which is that part of the story I'm telling is about the investment of enthusiasm into a term. So you can find people in the 18th century using this word in ways that sound like the standard 19th century usage, but it isn't a rallying cry. It isn't something that leads charges in German culture. And that kind of transformation seemed like a really explaining that accretion of emotion around the term seemed to me a big part of what I needed to do to carry off the argument. Particularly as a German historian working on topics like this, there's actually within German history, there's another sort of standard brand of history that what I'm doing is recognizable as, and that's something called conceptual history, Begriffsgeschichte, which is sort of a kind of standard mode of operating within the German historical profession, and it's associated with figures like Reinhard Koselleck. And there's a huge 6-volume reference work that I mentioned in my introduction that takes standard terms of modern political vocabulary, words like nation or citizen, and looks at the complicated histories of their usage. And that was something that I was sort of aware of all along, but how much what I was doing was like that. Also I think with some crucial differences was something that that I also realized only in the book revision stage for the most part. So that for a Germanist, that's an easy way for my German colleagues, that's an easy way to explain what the book is about. You know, it's a sort of joint conceptual and social history of of natural science as a concept, and they know what that means, at least loosely.
Great. Well, so you've already mentioned for us this term Naturwissenschaft that's very central to the book. And the book, in fact, we might as well start at the very beginning. So it traces the emergence of a category that we might think of or translate as science, and we might not. And you can sort of talk us through the issues involved in that later on in the discussion. Traces the emergence of this category within German-speaking Europe between 1770 and 1850. And you've mentioned the importance of the emerging of Naturwissenschaft as a kind of rallying cry. And you chart this by looking at the relationships between a kind of changes in development of a concept, a word, and as you mentioned, sort of a group, so sites of collective social action. So Denise, when you were looking at this set of phenomena, why this period in particular? What makes this particular period in German history so rich for looking at the kinds of phenomena that you wanted to look at?
That's a really good question, because originally the study was supposed to start in 1815 and go to 1870 and be entirely a 19th century story. That was when I started researching the dissertation, what I thought I was going to do. And I guess the further I get into my career, the more fascinated I am by the transformations that take place in that rough century covered in the book. So between the mid-18th and the mid-19th century, which is also the sort of standard label for that within the German historiography, the Zwischenzeit, which means the saddle period, or this kind of period of transition between the early modern and the modern. And it's a period of enormous upheaval in German society and politics for all kinds of reasons, not the least of them being the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. But it's a world that is still not completely familiar, that is foreign and in interesting ways, but is just sort of close enough to our own conceptual universe, I think, to be really interesting. And that, I think that's what's sort of fascinating to me about this project, and also some other stuff that I'm working on now, is kind of watching the familiar snap into focus, or categories that that we use in our own intellectual universes today, and being able to see the world just before that happens and watch that come into being, I find very interesting.
That's great. Now, science emerged, or there were various terms and concepts here that emerged as a label at the same time that the Enlightenment public, as you tell us, was becoming larger, it was becoming more complex, and it was becoming much more multi-layered. The relationship between the evolution of science or different modes of science and the changing nature of the public or public or publics is really crucial. Oh, excuse me. Aha. That was a little...
Okay.
Sore throat break in New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Okay. So the relationship between the evolution of science and the changing nature of public or publics is really crucial to what you're arguing here. So let's actually turn for a moment and go from science as our focus and talk about this other word that's been cropping up in what we've been talking about, and that's the word public. This is a very kind of plural notion here, and one of the most important things you're arguing, at least from the perspective of a reader, is that, you know, when we think about this concept or term public, it's not at all a simplistic thing, right, or a singular thing in this context. So can you talk about that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, that was another thing that it took me a while to work out for myself, because there's a literature out there, as you know, about the bourgeois public sphere, and one of the questions that initially motivated the project was thinking about the nature of bourgeois identity in science. And it took me a while to let go of that and to realize that this unitary bourgeois public sphere that had been so important in the initial stages of conceptualizing my research wasn't really what I needed to talk about. And that in fact, this older category that of learnedness, which if you read the secondary literature, you don't really think is going to be important to a project that stretches into the mid-19th century. It was really about learned identity in a lot of cases, and this being a part of the Republic of Letters in some meaningful sense that was the status issue for a lot of the people I was looking at, and also the boundary issue too, what people were trying to keep people out of. Mm-hmm. And then also that, I think that there's a lot of work, or an argument you could also make, if you were to revisit some older issues about the emergence of disciplines in the 19th century, that could also be usefully framed in terms of these specialized publics that I talk about in the introduction, some, the botanical public, right? I mean, which is a somewhat different way of conceptualizing what's going on than the older literature on professionalization and discipline building, I think, although it would cover some of the same ground.
Great. Thank you. So before we get into the first chapter, there's another really interesting conceptual issue that comes up in the introduction that you've actually alluded to in describing one of the things that brought you to this project in the first place, and that's the issue of comparison. So throughout the book, you either allude to or directly invoke comparisons between what's happening in the German-speaking world and also what's happening in a kind of comparable case in France or in England. So for a moment, let's just look directly at this. Why did you decide at various points to invoke this kind of comparative framework? And what does that sort of framework allow us to see in this case study that you're presenting us with, a really wonderful case study that we wouldn't be able to see just by focusing on the German-speaking world in particular?
I think as is often the case with comparative history, it helps to show the contingency of things that can seem self-evident. But that's it. I think that's something that we as historians of science are very familiar with. The fact that this isn't an inevitable category, the fact that you could have people who are talking to each other and are part of an interrelated intellectual tradition, that is the kind of pan-European community of people interested in the natural sciences, who are nonetheless coming up with different categories that don't all map onto each other. I think too, there's within German history, there's a sort of long tradition of writing with that implicit comparative eye. And a lot of the debates that have driven the field for the last 30, 40 years have been about how much Germany was or wasn't like France or Britain and what that means for the longer trajectories of German history. So I think there's part of it is trained as a German historian, you get kind of used to those sorts of questions. and it feels a very natural thing and almost a necessary thing to do. And particularly, needing to work. I think given the way some of these historiographical debates have gone, it's particularly important within German history to articulate clearly what sorts of differences you see. I mean, I think there, I very much didn't want this story, which is about a German particularity, to be read as a sort of older version of the Sonderweg debate that sees sees Germany on a kind of pathological path already in the early part of the 19th century in comparison to Britain or France.
Great. Now, thank you so much for talking so much about these methodological issues. I think these are really, really interesting. And as we get into the book, I think we'll also see how some of these issues will come up again in the individual chapters, like in really interesting ways. Okay, so when we get to the first chapter, Natural Knowledge and the Learned Public and the Enlightenment, this chapter opens by actually taking us through the history of one of these central terms that we've been talking about, and certainly a central term for the book, and that's the term and the category Naturwissenschaft. So for listeners who may not be familiar with this term and its history, can you talk a little bit about that? How does that map onto, or not, what we call science?
So in the 18th century, it's a composite word, and it first appears in a book title in the very early 18th century, and you can sort of find it used occasionally. And it's in German, it's a composite word. Natur means nature, obviously, and Wissenschaft is an older word that can mean kind of knowledge in general, or sometimes learned knowledge in particular. And this becomes a much more common composite, particularly in the last third of the 18th century. It's a word people use more often, but they use it sometimes to mean natural history, sometimes to mean natural philosophy, which are two different categories in the early modern period, and sometimes to mean a much broader range of engagements with nature than the later 19th century category. So they'll lump all sorts of kind of technological knowledge, what the 19th century would call an applied science, under this term too. So it's sort of fuzzier and looser in the 18th century, and also sometimes can mean different things. I think you can already see, which is one of the things I'm arguing in these early chapters, you can already sort of see a certain community emerging, but it doesn't have nearly the sharp boundaries that it did later on by the 19th century.
Great. Great, thank you. Now, another term that comes up here as really central is the history of the term or the history of the concept Naturforscher. So the meaning of this, as you show us, I think very compellingly here, changes over time. Can you explain what that means for our listeners and why it's important to the work that you're doing in this chapter?
So roughly it means, a natural researcher is how I translated it literally in a lot of parts of the book. It's a term that Germans stopped using when they, in the 19th century, when they start using Naturwissenschaftler, which is like scientist. So it's a sort of, somebody who in his range of interests, is similar to the modern professionalized science, but, is in other ways embedded in this, initially in this, 18th century and then early 19th century intellectual space I'm describing. So has some, is whose primary affiliation is not yet the affiliations of a modern professionalized researcher, but are bound more by the learned world I'm exploring.
Great. Now, the learned world that you just brought up is makes me think of the learned public, right, that you're chronicling or that you're introducing us to in this chapter. One of the things that the chapter's arguing in that, the argument in the rest of the book will also continue to allude to is the existence of multiple publics, multiple sort of overlapping and engaging publics. How does this learned public or learned world that you mentioned differ from the broader public or the broader marketplace for cultural goods in this period? And why is that important?
So there's a higher entry fee to be a member of the learned public. You have to be someone who's part of a set of social relationships that don't just exist of commodity exchange. You have to have recognition from other people who were already in this community, already recognized as learned. You have to be actively engaging in certain kinds of activities. Often you have to have certain kinds of possessions, depending on what your interests are, the right instruments, the right collections, the right books, or at least access to the same. So there's a much higher set of material and social entry requirements than to be a member of the general enlightened public. In the 18th century. And this is something that's very much recognized at the time, that people don't always employ this distinction consistently, but the difference between being that type of a person and just being, say, a person sitting in a theater audience or reading, the reader of a journal is definitely something that people recognize.
Now, one of the things that you sort of follow this into, or one of the aspects that you continue to develop this notion in the next chapter, is by showing us that learned networks of natural knowledge were often very socially heterogeneous. So can you talk a little bit about that? What kinds of people were involved in these learned networks, and how might we be surprised by some of them, or might we be surprised at all?
Yeah, they're, one of the incorporated towns, a place like Nuremberg, you have figures like Jakob Strom, who I talk about in the introduction, who's an engraver and printer, who's tied into these networks. You have gardeners, particularly the gardeners of important courts or very wealthy noblemen, often possessed a really significant amount of botanical knowledge and were very well connected within exchange networks. You also have, certain kinds of skilled craftsmen, people coming out, say, of the porcelain manufactories being set up in Central Europe who have really extensive chemical knowledge. There are also people who are kind of chemical and electrical showmen on occasion that end up as part of these networks. So people who are making a living by entertaining the enlightened public. And that's part of what creates a lot of the anxiety that you see as well, that gets particularly strong by the late 18th century, is the fact that you have on the one hand people who are from kind of traditional learned backgrounds, right? Members of one of the learned professions, people who've studied at a university. And then you have a variety of other kinds of folks who possess, in a lot of cases, a lot of expertise and are interesting people to be in exchange with, but who also create some status difficulties for Naturforscher, particularly over and against other members of what in the 18th century was called the learned estate. So, you know, you don't find, say, historians or people whose primary interest lies in history or philology consorting with a very wide range of kinds of people in the course of doing their research. And that was something that was true for Naturforscher, that they were dealing with instrument makers, with gardeners, with engravers and printers in certain kinds of ways. And this was something that, you know, in the late 18th century was still a particular status issue for a group of people who still looked down on people that used their hands, for one thing. So Naturforscher were always at risk of, seeming like artisans, which is something that people have written about for the 17th century as well. And that issue very much carries forward into my period and this part of the story I'm telling as well.
Thank you so much. Now, one of the things that's really interesting and that's important to the early chapters, but also later on, is that you're showing us the importance of relationships between the general and the local, and particular localities wind up playing a very important role in this story. One of the localities that is particularly important for this early chapter is Dresden. So can you talk a little bit about what makes Dresden so interesting and important for this story, and in what way did some of the local context that you're looking at here shape the kinds of stories that you're telling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the fact that I chose Dresden definitely pulled the book in certain directions. And I tried to sort of look at some other different kinds of cities to balance that out a bit. But I thought Dresden was interesting in part just because of the simple fact that it had so many generalist natural scientific societies in comparison to other places. So it allowed me to see things that changed and happened as part of a slower transition in some other locales in Dresden resulted in the founding of a new society. And so it was sort of easier to see breaks there. But it was also interesting because it's a kind of environment that historians of science haven't looked at much in the German case. It's a really important court center with a very ambitious dynasty that... some of the people that I focus on in later chapters, Reichenbach, are both courtiers and, appointees of the Saxon royal family. And there's a lot around the court that relates to things that we as historians of science care about. And that's something that that hasn't really been very widely explored in the history of German science for this period. And it's also a place that doesn't have a university. It has a medical academy, but not a university. And given the way that universities as institutions have kind of dominated discussion of German science in the first half of the 19th century, I thought that would be really useful to have my home base be in a place that was an important intellectual center, but didn't have a university. So to see what that looks like, it was helpful, I felt like, for the project.
Okay. Thank you so much. So as we move into the later chapters of the book and we move away from Dresden, although we'll see Dresden again and we move into other kinds of contexts, one of the things that starts happening is a distinction begins to be drawn between natural history, natural philosophy, and the practical sciences of nature. And this is a distinction that continues to be fleshed out in different ways through the end of the period that you're looking at. So can you talk about this a little bit? This is sort of, how did this distinction between more kind of natural history, natural philosophy sorts of endeavors and more practical endeavors emerge? And why did that emerge in this particular way in the period you're looking at?
So this is actually that shift that I talk about in the middle part of the book is something that in some ways is a very familiar shift to German historians and historians of German science, this rise of the ideal of pure Wissenschaft that rejects Enlightenment utilitarianism with its interest in making knowledge practical. And one of the things that I was really struck by looking at associational life is the degree to which this really represents a kind of strategic retreat. It's not as if the figures in this period, they also have plenty of connections to practical endeavor, but there is this just exploding field of practical science, particularly around agriculture in this time period. that these, you know, the sort of learned estate can no longer manage. I was really struck by, in the way the traditional story goes, it sort of sees this new ideal of Wissenschaft eclipsing Enlightenment utilitarianism. And that's putting it a little too stark. I mean, people have recognized that there were continuities before, certainly. But, you know, the degree to which this is a sort of defensive posture, and one that also comes with the creation of a new public for practical science that really is, you know, certainly still has respect to a certain degree for university professors and other people they would view as theorists, but that really has its own dynamic, its own membership, its own concerns, and that feels quite confident about setting its own priorities. And that's actually my second book is going to be about the agricultural sciences, and I'm more convinced than ever that that's the right take on what's going on in the 19th century.
Oh, great. Cool. So we'll look forward to seeing that book as well. Okay, great. So as we move into this story and sort of get later into this period in the 19th century that you're moving into, we come to a chapter that looks, chapter 4, that looks at how local learned societies help Germany's university-educated elite distinguish themselves from the increasing crowd of other new authors and collectors and other people who are emerging in this field. Now, this has something to do here, as you mentioned, with the Romantic era's enthusiasm for the unity of natural knowledge. And this idea of a kind of unified natural knowledge is something that you talk about a little bit earlier in the book as well. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that for what happens in this period when we have university-educated elite trying to distinguish themselves?
Yeah, I always felt like chapter 4 was sort of the fulcrum chapter of the book, that in some ways that's the most important chapter somehow. And that moment is really the crucial moment in the consolidation of this category. What I think is particularly important to me about that part of the book is to show the importance of local identity in the lives of this emerging elite, and the ways in which that's part of what makes this new unified ideal of science so appealing is that Germany really is very precocious as a land of specialized journals. And so, you know, on the one hand, the people that you're looking at in those societies are people who are very active, in most cases as published authors, or at least the leaders in the societies are, and who are part of specialized conversations with people of similar interests, you know, all over the place. And a lot of what they're wrestling with is how do you transfer those specialized conversations back into a form that gives you some kind of credit and status in your everyday environment. And I think those kind of pressures are an important part of the explanation for why German scientific associational life ends up looking the way that it does. That you know, on the one hand, I think other historians have made a fairly convincing case, are probably more intensely specialized than their, say, French or British counterparts. And more fragmented politically. They don't have a single social center and social political center to which they can go. And that problem of guarding and preserving a reputation in that sort of an environment makes these local generalist groups very important. And I think that that's part of what puts flesh on the bones, if you will, of this romantic ideal of the unity of science, which I think is, I don't know that I would want to draw the directional arrows one way or the other. I mean, I think part of the reason people talk about those ideals so much is precisely the appeal of these kinds of forum where they can broadcast what they're doing to their peers in their local cities and towns and get recognition for it and have it matter in a meaningful day-to-day way in who they are in their daily settings.
Right. And one of the things that you say, and that I think is a really important point in this chapter, is that these general kind of multidisciplinary scientific forums that you're describing, the ones that were founded in this period, they're not at odds with more directed disciplinary discussion. They're rather complementary to it. And I think this is really an example of a broader methodological set of moves that you're making in the book when you seem to be urging us to avoid understanding history through recourse to simple binaries, right? There's throughout the book, there's a reminder that it's not one way or the other. This wasn't necessarily a matter of a stark choice that people were making. Rather, these existed in a kind of ecology that wasn't black or white. There was a lot of movement among what we might think of as these poles or two different modes of being.
I think I might even put it more strongly than that. The appeal of these generalist forums was in many ways directly related to the emergence of more intense forms of specialization. That in it actually made local generalist sociability more important for people. And I think one of the ways that you can really see that is that a lot of the previous literature on these societies a lot of times would kind of pick out specialist groups and say, aha, there we see modern disciplinary specialization in an early form. And the generalist groups were supposed to be part of some earlier stage. And if you look at the geography of specialized versus generalist groups in Germany in this time period, the specialist groups are often in kind of small and not very important places, and their members are all often not very eminent. And the fact that they're so specialized is a mark of modesty on their part in a lot of cases. That's how they themselves perceive it. And when they become more ambitious and want to attract more attention, then they become a generalist society. There are several cases of that.
Now, as we sort of move into the closing chapters of the book, or the last half of the book, I guess, one of the things that you look at in the next chapter in particular is you're introducing these two figures that I think you alluded to earlier in our discussion in the context of looking at the ways that learned men of the 19th century kind of pitched their cause to members of the educated estates, as you called them, and also the wider literary and social public. Now, one of the things that emerges for both of these figures, or in the case of both of these figures, is the importance of gender as a sticking point for both of these men who were trying to sort of negotiate to push their agendas through. Can you talk a little bit about that as it emerged as an issue for you? Because gender emerges very explicitly in this chapter, but there are also other places in the book where you talk about the importance of bringing that into the way we're understanding these phenomena.
One of the key boundary markers of the learned public was gender. And there are a few cases of people who make it to the other side of that boundary, but that is a fairly standard understanding for the time period that I'm talking about. And in, I think particularly in the 20s and 30s, this becomes a potential problem for Naturforscher who are trying to craft a certain kind of public identity that borrows on models of literary heroes. This is the time period of the emergence of Germany's national literature, really, the time period the book covers. There are these new literary heroes like Schiller and Goethe who are still in the process of being canonized, but clearly the two men I'm talking about in this chapter deeply admire what those people like that have been able to pull off in terms of the public figure they're able to cut and the kind of attention they're able to attract. I think Reichenbach, who offers evening entertainments to a mixed polite public in Dresden, is clearly very interested in being taken seriously by the circle surrounding the court. He wants women to care about what he does. He wants them in his audience. He wants them as readers, because that's part in practice of being acclaimed in the broader literary public sphere. And there are a number of things about natural science that make that a little tricky. It has still a lot of utilitarian overtones for the general public, coming out of enlightened traditions. And in, official conventional wisdom, women are not supposed to be too concerned with utilitarian things. Natural science, it's got some ties through a German discipline called Cameralism to governance in the state, another male purview. And things like natural history also have a reputation for being very pedantic. It's one of the common criticisms people make. It's the kind of providence of small-minded and the asocial. And those are all potential liabilities, I think, that people like Reichenbach and Nies von Essenbeck face in trying to make a bigger splash within the broader public culture. And so I think for each of them, the issue of gender becomes making the argument that this is also something that should interest women is an important, they see that as an important point to win.
Great. Thanks, Denise. So as we move also forward into the book, and I know there's a ton of material in here that's really fascinating, and there's no way we're going to have time to talk about all of it, but I want to make sure that we hit on at least a couple of the really important points that are happening, or the important moves that are happening in these last three chapters before the conclusion. So the chapter 6, The Nature of the Fatherland, in particular speaks to one of the kinds of phenomena that you mentioned earlier in our conversation, which is the importance of the regional or the local to what's happening in this story. This chapter looks, among other things, at the ways that naturalists negotiated local and regional practices of natural history with larger sort of emerging concepts of the German nation. So Kent, for our listeners, can you talk a little bit about the importance of regional natural history within this larger context of sort of emerging German nationhood?
This is a really interesting time period in that process because you've got already among educated Germans a sense of a German cultural nation. There are debates going on about precisely what political form that ought to take in some circles. And you also have the dynastic states of German-speaking Europe working very hard in these decades to build a greater sense of state loyalty among their subjects. You have people who were part of regions that got stuck on to a larger state after 1815 that don't really like where they ended up and who, as a result, cultivate an independent sense of regional identity that's different from their dynastic identity and that might or might not also be tied in with this broader sense of belonging to the German nation more widely. And natural history and the practice of natural history is very much tied up in that broader political process of negotiating what counts as a community, what comes together, and what doesn't. You see already in the 30s and 40s a real proliferation of these local societies. But I think that this political negotiation definitely isn't the only thing that drives that. I think a lot of what you see going on are these, what I call in an earlier part of the book, these new men. So people kind of coming in at the fringes of the educated estates, reappropriating a lot of the tools of the learned public and trying to get recognition and credit from people, both more eminent people and also just from other peers with similar interests.
Thank you. So speaking of localities, the next chapter takes us from the kinds of context that we were looking at. And you mentioned specific areas before, like we talked about Dresden, for example. The next chapter focuses in particular on Saxony as a location of study. So can you talk about that a little bit? What about Saxony were you interested in, and how was that ideal for looking at the kinds of phenomena, sort of emerging discourses of sort of technical academies and technical education and modernity that you look at in this chapter?
the most precociously industrial parts of Germany, and it's also quite urban. And so it's this sort of interesting place to look at what are going to become, you know, even more well-developed and defining trends in the second half of the 19th century. And one of the things that really struck me in writing that chapter, you know, there's a real tendency to assume that natural science as a category gets a lot of credit from the technological innovations of the 30s and 40s and, you know, railway enthusiasm. And I found that to be true to a certain extent. And it's definitely true if you're looking at professors at technical academies who are often university-trained men with those kinds of allegiances. But if you read a lot of the industrial promotion literature, that concept almost never comes up. And it's the more general concept of Wissenschaft, sort of science in general, that is still the rallying cry for the practical folks. And that I thought was a really interesting disjuncture. And another sign of how limited the conceptual influence can sometimes be of the university-educated elite. I mean, it's, you know, yet another example of the practical sciences sort of forging their own way.
Now, as we come to the close of the book, and as we sort of come to the close of our questions before I ask you just a couple things to wrap up, the final chapter before the conclusion really takes us into a really interesting case in which you look at the distinction between two branches of the sciences that might kind of roughly map onto the natural sciences on the one hand and the social sciences and humanities on the other. And I say that knowing that this is not a perfect mapping, but sort of for the sake of you know, sort of talking about it right now. So central to this chapter, and this sort of brings us, I think, full circle from what one of the things that you were talking about earlier in the conversation, in this context allowing us to sort of relook at and re-understand and reimagine some of the fundamental aspects of contemporary science that we might take for granted. This chapter, I think, among other things, really asks us to think again about what the history of something that seems as fundamental to science, like the scientific method, might look like in different contexts and different places. So crucial to this chapter, and really this kind of, I think, acts as a kind of culmination for the reader of the book, is the emergence of the idea of a natural scientific method, or perhaps multiple scientific methods. So can you talk about that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah. This is a chapter that's about mostly about a set of educational debates that are going on in the sort of middle third of the 19th century in Germany that I think are really shaping the rhetoric and some of the shared conceptual assumptions about science that exist from then on. And I think the key topic of the chapter is this idea that the natural sciences are somehow epistemologically distinct from other kinds of knowledges, particularly the human sciences, social sciences, the humanities, and that they have perhaps their own unique method that's fundamentally different from the method of the humanities and the social sciences. And this becomes, in the later 19th century, there's a very famous set of high-powered philosophical debates called the Methodenstreit about precisely this issue, and it's remained kind of, it's sort of like C.P. Stowe's Two Cultures for people in the Anglo-American world. This is kind of a sort of standard thing to gesture to in the German intellectual tradition. I think this is... This is really what makes science into something that can define an age, right? Because this set of debates is really what solidifies this idea that science has its own distinct way of looking at the world that somehow is quite different from how other bodies of knowledge deal with the world. So it detaches it to a new degree from the more general prestige of learned knowledge in general and gives it its own set of epistemological characteristics. And then after that happens, you start to see the particularly the adjective natural scientific used in all kinds of new ways. So there's, you know, in the 50s, there's a natural scientific school of law, which is literally something that just wouldn't even have made linguistic sense, really, or would have meant something very, very different in the 18th century. Or, you know, the new natural scientific medicine that Neurochow helps to popularize. There are all sorts of iterations and ways in which the natural sciences can be seen as imbuing other things with their qualities that I think weren't really part of the conceptual universe of the pre-1840 period in the same way, even when people talked about the value of natural philosophy and natural history for other kinds of pursuits.
Great. Well, Denise, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. And I know that we didn't get to, I know and you know, but listeners may not know as much. There's a ton of material in the book that we didn't get to. It's an extraordinarily rich study, and it's full of really interesting stories and really interesting points that we didn't necessarily have a chance to talk about today. So is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to cover, but that you'd like to point out, especially for listeners who may not yet have had the opportunity to read the book?
Maybe I could mention briefly the way I chose to frame the conclusion, which is this: the story of a wedding that looks at two families whose family trees kind of capture all of the different, or more or less all of the different types of people that I talk about over the course of the study. And one of the things that I found very interesting about this study is the degree to which, as historians of science, I think this is a great example of how we can participate in issues of interest to general historians as well. Because one of the things that comes out when you look at the history of this category and who can or can't be associated with it, and also the difference between the learned and the educated public, is, there are a lot of divisions that German social historians take for granted, like between the educated public and the public. That when you look at scientific circles, get all mixed up. That was something that was kind of an important point of the study for me, was also a contribution to the kind of typology of the German social field in the 19th century and the role that we as historians of science can play in helping to sort that out as well.
Great. So you mentioned earlier on that your next project might be something on agricultural sciences. And so I was going to ask you, what's inspiring you now? What are you working on now? And what can we hope to read about in the future? Is it that project? And if so, and or if not, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So a book on the agricultural sciences in Germany in roughly the same time period. And my interest in this grew out of a lot of the material I was looking at, for example, for chapter 3 or chapter 2. I got interested in kind of noble participation in science. I just spent a year in Germany doing research for that. And what that book is shaping up to be about is really an examination of how science and the market interact. And particularly, I mean, this is, and it's also sort of going to be organized as another history of concepts. This time the kind that I'm interested in is the market as a category. Because I think that the history of the natural sciences actually, and the agricultural sciences, play an important role in how people in Europe and in Germany in this time period go from understanding a market as an event or a location, right? The yearly Leipzig wool market or whatever, to a more generalized modern conception that involves the market as a sort of abstract set of forces, which of course you can already find in high political economy in the 18th century. But I'm interested in looking at how within agricultural science that understanding of what is to be an economic agent, what sort of field you're operating in as an economic agent, how agricultural science is part of that very important shift. Something that takes this out of the pages of British political economy and makes it a concept that the Germans actually use. And I think that that agriculture is a really important, commercialized agriculture is a really important location for that story.
Well, sounds great. Best of luck with that research. And Denise, thank you so much for joining us and talking with me about your book today. It's a great book and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.